From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, John Engler forced to resign as Michigan State University's interim president.
John Engler's ill-advised and hurtful, harmful comments has really not allowed the university to move forward.
Don't stop now, because this isn't enough. There is so much left to be done.
Teachers quitting at a record rate, putting more stress on remaining teachers.
Not only are they seeing colleagues heading for the exits, but they're seeing a really toxic environment as well.
From Frankenmuth, Michigan to the world stage, rock group Greta Van Fleet.
As much ambition as we had to create something of success, you know, I don't think that any of us had predicted such immediate reaction to what we were doing and what we're doing now.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan State University's Board of Trustees has named a new interim president. Satish Udpa will replace John Engler, who resigned last night before this morning's board meeting when he would have been fired. Udpa has been MSU's Executive VP for Administrative Services since 2013, and before that, he was Dean of the School of Engineering. Diane Byram is chair of the MSU Board of Trustees and is here now. It has been a tumultuous 11 months since the board voted unanimously to bring John Engler in as interim president. Why was this the moment that he had to either resign or be fired?
Well, this has been building, quite frankly. You know, John Engler's ill-advised and hurtful, harmful comments has really not allowed the university to move forward. Every time we start to move forward on reforms and trying to start healing for the survivors, we end up with these missteps that have Michigan State on front page headlines across the state and across the nation, and that keeps drawing us backwards. And it just came to the point where we had to make a change.
And why was Satish Udpa the right choice to succeed Engler as interim president?
Well, Satish really came up organically as we started to have conversations when we were contemplating calling this special board meeting and making this move. He's well-known on campus. He's beloved by everyone. He's former dean of engineering. Students he's taught and interacted with, students adore him. The faculty are used to working with him. He's a highly respected scholar. And because he's been vice president of operations, all the major initiatives, the big picture items on just keeping the university focused on moving forward and making sure everything's running on time, Satish is at the center of all of that. So it just, all of those factors, plus the fact that he's a very humble person. He's a person that likes to work collaboratively, well-known, well-liked, well-respected. People could get excited about Satish as an interim president as we continue diligently to look for a new president.
And I know you're co-chair of the committee conducting that presidential search. What, Diane, do you most want to see in MSU's next president?
We need several things. I think personally, I want somebody that's going to be a good communicator and an empathetic leader. You know, the trustees didn't want to set forward a set of qualities that we thought should be in the next leader at Michigan State. So what we did was we went out across the campus community and held 22 input sessions, or listening sessions is another name for them, and took from the MSU community what they wanted in the next leader. And from that input, we wrote the presidential prospectus, and now we're going to be evaluating candidates based on what we heard from those input sessions to make sure that the next leader at Michigan State University has as many of those qualities and characteristics as the broader MSU community identified as their criteria and what's important to them.
I would like to pivot over to that final comments as Special Independent Prosecutor Bill Forsyth kind of wound things down at the end of last year. He did not hold back last month, complaining that MSU and its attorneys stonewalled his investigation into the Larry Nassar scandal. It talked about MSU's biggest concern was protecting its reputation. He said MSU issued misleading public statements, drowned investigators in irrelevant documents, and asserted attorney-client privilege when it didn't apply, and a lot more. Are you personally satisfied with the way the school responded to Forsyth's investigation?
What I can say is that I personally cooperated completely. I turned over my personal data. I was interviewed, and I complied in every way asked of me in a very timely and professional manner. As it relates to the attorney-client privilege, we currently have a judge, Judge Ball, looking at all of the documents that Michigan State has asserted privilege on, and frankly, they're not large in volume. And as the judge determines that they are not, in fact, privileged, then those will be turned over immediately to the Attorney General's office. That's the status that I can tell you from my perspective. The trustees have, from the beginning, although we may have struggled at times with how we've communicated with the survivor community, going forward, I believe we're in a position that we are reaching out to the survivors, we're engaging in conversation, dialogue with them, and we want to help them heal and move the university forward.
John Engler said the investigation into the school's handling of the Nassar scandal is over and that, in his words, officials are trying to go back to work. Do you agree with that statement?
I think the Attorney General will determine when the investigation is over, not anyone from the university. And all I can say is from my vantage point as a trustee, as well as co-chairing the search committee, our job now is to make sure that we are engaging in dialogue with the survivors. We are moving forward with necessary reforms so that we can look anyone in the eye and say, this will never happen again at Michigan State University. But it is going to be a journey. It is not something that will be able to fix in a day or a week or a month. And it is part of our history, and we need to learn from that history.
At the end of his 11-page resignation letter, Interim President Engler, who will be gone next Wednesday, basically stated that MSU is in a much, much stronger, better place than it was a year ago. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have made a lot of changes. One of the big activities that happened last year was to get the global settlement with the survivors. That was very important. It was important for the survivors so that they could start healing. And it was important to the university because at that point in time, we were able to then start a presidential search. We were not able, given the lack of a settlement, to have any serious search prospects. So I think that was important. There have been numerous reforms across the university. The issue has been for all of those reforms and new policies, positions, oversight, accountability, compliance, every time John Engler would make one of his ill-advised comments that was harmful, hurtful to the survivors, it set us back and undid all of the progress that we were making in terms of healing, and it opened up wounds for the survivors one more time. So we weren't even treading water. We were falling backwards. And so I think that culminated with today's action by the board to accept John Engler's resignation effective immediately.
Diane Byram, chair of the Michigan State University Board of Trustees. Thanks for spending time with us.
You're welcome.
Hilmar Ramos Gomez is a U.S. citizen born in Grand Rapids. He served in the Marines and saw combat in Afghanistan. And last month, federal immigration authorities took him into custody to face possible deportation. Attorneys and immigration advocates in West Michigan are now demanding to know why and how this happened. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer reports.
Hilmar Ramos Gomez's mother sat at a conference table yesterday in her attorney's office. In front of her, spread out across the table, were photos and documents of her son's accomplishments. His high school diploma, a photo of him in the Marines dress blues, white cap, black brim pulled low. Her name is Maria Gomez Velasquez. She remembers getting a call from her son telling her that he would be released from the Kent County Jail. When she went to pick him up, a jail employee told her he'd just left in a van filled with detainees held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE for short. Her attorney, Richard Kessler, helped translate her story.
Ustedes no pueden saber qué es lo que yo sentí cuando yo salí afuera.
You just can't understand what I felt like when I went outside.
Yo me puse a llorar amargamente. Me puse.
I started to cry bitterly.
Yo dije, no puedo creer.
I said, I can't believe this.
She cried, she prayed, and then she called an attorney. It was a Friday. She says it took until Monday to get him out. Hilmar Ramos Gomez wasn't at the law office yesterday. He hasn't spoken to reporters. His mom says he's currently getting treatment for his mental health issues, including PTSD, which she says he's been coping with since returning home from Afghanistan. Back in November, he was arrested by Grand Rapids police for trespassing onto the helipad area on the roof of a local hospital. He pled guilty to that charge, and a local judge ordered him released. But instead of releasing him, the Kent County Jail turned him over to the custody of ICE. The county did that based on a request from ICE, which claimed Ramos Gomez was in the country illegally. Richard Kessler, the attorney, is the one who called ICE to tell them they had a Marine War veteran locked up in their jail. He says he suspects Hilmar had told people all along he was a citizen.
They seemed shocked when I called and sent these documents that what he was saying was true.
A spokesperson for Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not reply to a request for comment yesterday. The Kent County Sheriff's Department says it's investigating the incident, but Under Sheriff Charles DeWitt says if there was a mistake, the mistake seems to have been made by ICE.
What we've done thus far is a review of the documents. And the review of the documents thus far have revealed that all the policies and procedures were followed.
Policies were followed because in Kent County, the policy is to cooperate with immigration enforcement whenever the agency makes a request to hold someone until they can get transferred to federal custody. Counties don't have to comply, but Kent County chooses to. Attorneys, including Miriam Aukerman of the ACLU of Michigan, have been warning for months that something almost exactly like what happened with Hilmar Ramos Gomez could happen.
What will it take? Did we have to really have to get to the point where a mentally ill combat veteran who served this country ends up locked up in immigration detention because of this policy of colluding with ICE?
Under Sheriff Charles DeWitt says the Kent County Sheriff's Department has no plans right now to stop cooperating with ICE. Maria Gomez Velasquez says she still wants answers for why her son was held for deportation. She says the case has shaken her faith in law enforcement.
But I don't like that, what they did to my son. King County need to wake up. They need to do their job.
Do their job, she says, and follow the law. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Frankenmuth is known for fried chicken, Bronner's, Christmas Wonderland, and a lot of Bavarian designs on the town's buildings. And now it is known to rock fans as the home of Greta Van Fleet. Brothers Josh, Jake, and Sam Kiska and drummer Danny Wagner released their first full-length album, Anthem of the Peaceful Army, only last October. Already, it's earned them Grammy nominations, a ton of attention, fans around the world, and this weekend they perform on NBC's Saturday Night Live. I recently spoke with guitarist Jake Kiska. Very happy to have you. And boy, I stop and I think about the fact your debut album gets you 4 Grammy nominations. You've got, some 2 million Spotify listeners, a world tour that is selling out. You're opening up the Saturday Night Live season on the 19th. Fair to say Greta Van Fleet is living its best life these days?
I think that's an accurate portrayal, yeah.
Did you feel inside like any of this might be happening back when you were like trying to get to third hour history at Frankenmuth High, which was not that long ago?
it's an interesting thing. As much ambition as we had to create something of success, I don't think that any of us had predicted such immediate reaction to what we were doing and what we're doing now. No.
Does it feel like things are maybe going a little too fast and too much, or is it not fast enough?
No, I think it's at a good perpetuating pace. It seems that per venue and every travel that we're doing, it's sort of gradual. And I think it's at a great pace.
I want to talk a little bit about you and your brothers growing up in Frankenmuth with parents who owned a lot of vinyl, because as a parent, I sure took away the fact reading about you guys. If there was ever a reminder, kids will soak up the music that their parents have. You three Kiske brothers are it. So what kind of records do they have, and what did you listen to growing up?
You know, it was an interesting collection, and it's quite an eclectic collection. I think a lot of it sort of initially was a lot of roots music, and that was sort of a lot of blues records, folk and soul, R&B, and jazz, some jazz and classical. But, you know, it was like, I think, you know, in particular, it was the blues albums that we initially started listening to quite a lot. And that was, you know, artists like Elmore James, Lytton Hopkins, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, Albert King, you know, all the Kings. And, you know, it seemed like that was what we were most attracted to initially. And then, you know, it goes into Aretha and a lot of the R&B singers and folk, which was, again, in a lot of the, in the traditional sense, it was, you know, Arlo Guthrie. And then, you know, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, John Denver was a big one. So, yeah, it was kind of, well, it was pretty expansive, I suppose, in terms of those influences, what was, you know, sort of around in the vinyl form. And so, yeah, we picked up quite a bit of that, I suppose.
Well, you certainly did in your guitar playing. I watched the segment with you sitting in Nikki Sixx's basement with him playing riffs, and you can really hear that blues influence. And boy, you are quite a guitarist. When did you first pick up a guitar? How old were you?
I think it was about 3 or 4, I think, when I was really attracted to it. And, yeah, didn't seem to put it down. My dad would leave his instruments out, and his bass and his guitar, and we'd crawl around it. And then Mom would say, pick it up, because they're going to destroy it. And said, oh, they'll get bored of it at some point. And I never did, so.
Now, when you all formed the band around 2012, were you still in school then, or were you out at that point?
We were still in school, yeah, actually. The first tour that we did, Sam and Daniel were seniors in high school still. And, yeah, that was an interesting thing.
What do you remember about the very first time that you and you know, you stood up as a band to play in front of an audience?
It was a very freeing thing. You know, I think about the first show that we actually ever played was a festival in our hometown in Frankenmuth. I think it was Autofest, and we were up on a trailer, and we were using a generator, yeah, to power the stage. And I think it just in general, it's such a free feeling to be able to stand up and play. You know, having been rehearsing and having, you know, been playing years prior to that, to be able to actually, you know, get up in front of people for the first time. Certainly, there's a lot of fear involved in that initially, and. But, yeah, it's a feeling, I think, unlike any other. I think that's, yeah, it was a very free feeling.
I know you've told the story a bazillion times, but please humor us. Please tell us the story of your band's name, because it's a great one.
Yeah, thank you. Sort of started prior to that show, the first show that we'd played, and we needed a name. And, you know, we'd been, I think, debating a few things for quite some time. And I think it was a previous drummer who, you know, had to leave practice early, and, you know, he's like, sorry, I have to go help my grandpa cut wood for Gretna Van Fleet. And I think it was Josh who was like, oh, that's a name, that's quite interesting. So we took it and dropped the N out, and that was the name from that point forward. And yeah, it turns out she's, you know, a musician in town, actually, and I think the name is a descendant of Dutch origins. And so, yeah, it became a quite interesting thing, especially when we put up her name on the marquee in town at a little hall called Fisher Hall that we were playing. And everybody's calling her. I'm like, are you playing? Are you playing the Fisher Hall? And she's like, I certainly hope not. I've been practicing. So, yeah, so she showed up.
And she is a seasoned human being, right? Should we put it that way?
Yes, correct. Yeah, I think I'm early 80s now.
You know, I wondered, I know that Greta Van Fleet opened for Bob Seger in Saginaw in the fall of 2017. You were really starting to attract attention. And I just wondered what you take away from his career as this rocker over decades who kept his Michigan roots. Did he have any thoughts for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we certainly sort of talked, and he'd, you know, given us some of his knowledge. And I think, you know, just seeing someone of that age at that proficiency, you know, and still going, it's like him a lot like others, is sort of like a prototype, you know, for rock and roll and how far you can go and how long you can play. And he's still doing it, and he's still performing really well. So that was certainly something that we took away from that.
I got to say, for someone like me who's a baby boomer, it is really great to hear the four of you reflecting that big riff rock that I know I loved when it first came out, with big drums and big guitar and wailing vocals. And I got to ask you, Jake, there are some music critics kind of complaining that Greta Van Fleet sounds too much like Led Zeppelin. To that?
You know, it's an interesting thing, and again, like, it's, you know, everybody's entitled to a certain opinion, and by means of that, in terms of our influence, Led Zeppelin was certainly a large one in influencing us and our sound, and, you know, taking out of creative identity and sort of listening to what it truly is, specifically in terms of its sound. Yeah, I think that maybe they should go to a live show and then determine from that point what the opinion going forward would be, I suppose.
Well, it's interesting. Speaking of live shows, I am looking right now on the Greta Van Fleet website and your upcoming the world tour, and you are going. It is an big old school world tour with Japan and Australia and New Zealand and Spain and Netherlands. You're doing it all. What I also notice is all kinds of already sold out shows. Is this as much fun seeing this thing happening for you? And stop and say and realize that your debut album just came out last October. Is this as much fun as you thought it would be when you were back at Frankenmuth High?
Absolutely, and more.
Does being in the band with your brothers, is that help you guys stay grounded?
Yeah, certainly. I think family is a great grounding element. Yeah, when we come home, and yeah, just having brothers on the road, and I suppose even, you know, Daniel, who's very much a brother in that sense, that it, when someone starts straying in one way or another, that there's someone very close by to pull you back in.
Knock you off your peg a little down there on that pedestal.
Yes.
So SNL, this you know, coming, opening up the season, and then the world tour, when do you think you're going to get back to Frankenmuth?
Ooh, I'm not sure. A few months, maybe.
Well, we want to wish you the best of luck. Have fun with SNL. Good luck at the Grammys with those four nominations. You going to bring Mom and Dad to the Grammys?
We may, if they're not busy.
Jake from Greta Van Fleet, it's been great talking with you, and much success always. Thank you so very much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, Cindy.
And now to the classroom with the question, why are teachers giving up on teaching? Recent reporting in the Wall Street Journal tells us in the first 10 months of 2018, public educators quit at the highest rate since the Labor Department started tracking all of that back in 2001. Matenga Ragatz is Stateside's education contributor with us now via Skype. Matenga, what's driving teachers out of the classroom at this record rate?
Cindy, it's such a sad story because teachers are the nicest people in the neighborhood, and people go into the profession with the biggest heart, and they just pour everything they have with no expectation of getting anything back. But I'm telling you, legislators and decision makers have lost the plot. You know, the purpose of education has now become a race for test scores and a springboard to just like instant debt without guarantee. And now we are no longer talking about, you know, how many kids have reasonable skill sets for success. We talk instead about how many kids are applying for college.
So am I hearing you say it is the legislative fingers in the pie and this whole, you know, teaching to test that has changed the environment?
It is. And I'm not going to just kind of tip it towards one side. It is just the culture that we've developed. And so because of that culture, we have this, you know, hyper focus on data collection, which implies more paperwork for teachers. And so, you know, the data collection needs a curriculum that is very specific, which is soul draining to the teachers. And so that also snowballs into, okay, now we have to put in these standards. And so what we are seeing is a culture of stress rather than as a culture to uplift the profession.
Are teachers who are leaving, by and large, maybe not a good fit for the profession? Or are we losing people who are so passionate about teaching, but they're burning out?
Yeah. And the ones that are leaving the fastest are the ones that are really, truly passionate. You know, the unrealistic expectations are just burning teachers. And so, you know, by unrealistic expectations, Cindy, I mean things like unmanageable class sizes, ineffective administrators, frivolous meetings, lack of materials, and nonsense regulations. And you know, I'd love for you to hear what Bobby Joe Kenyon, who's a 20-year business and biology high school teacher who also left the classroom. I'd love for you to hear what she has to say.
Teaching is getting tougher throughout the years. There's more on the shoulders of teachers. Accountability, especially when you work in an inner city school, where it is hard when you have kids coming in that are at third and fourth grade levels of reading and math.
You know, it's a very clear message of dissatisfaction. Matinga, where are teachers ending up when they leave the classroom?
You know, of course, it's a complex matter, and teachers, it's a very personal journey. But a lot of teachers are going into the consulting route. There's a lot of private businesses now that are in the education system, selling the education system these big box curriculum or these books or strategies. And so a lot of these businesses are seeking out teachers to write their materials. And so a lot of them are going into consulting, and a lot of them also are going into coaching. They become instructional coaches as well.
And here you are. I mean, you were Michigan Teacher of the Year, and you're in the National Teacher Hall of Fame, and you're not in a classroom anymore.
I am not in the classroom. And for me personally, it was, you know, I'm an innovator. I'm a creative person. And it's really, really difficult here in Michigan to innovate from the inside.
What kind of impact is this having on student learning and school culture?
It has a big impact. And see, what we're seeing right now is just a revolving door of teachers. And we have just lower performance altogether, absenteeism. I think one of the biggest things that I see is this lack of organic community building. And there's just the human connection is lost, because I don't feel that our interest is no longer the children, is more the outcome of the curriculum.
And I have to wonder how this hits the teachers left behind, especially the young teachers, those new faces in the schools who are starting their education careers, and they're seeing colleagues heading for the exits.
They are. Not only are they seeing colleagues heading for the exits, but they're seeing a really toxic environment as well. And of course, I am painting a really wide brush, because I'm sure there are pockets of schools that are really, really doing a good job. But the younger teachers especially, they're coming in with very little mentoring and very little preparation for really what they're about to, like the expectations of the job right now. And the unrealistic expectations has gotten to where, we know people cannot keep up, and it's especially because the pay does not equal the work that you have to do. As you know, many teachers have what we call the summer gig, which is a job in the summer so that you can pay your bills. And it's just, you know, it's an embarrassing situation.
What could legislators and policymakers do to keep teachers from leaving?
You know, with all due respect, Cindy, I would love the legislators to go about sorting out the problems of the roads and let the school fixing for the people who are trained and have lots of experiences on how to fix the schools. And like my good friend Melody Arabu will tell you, you know, she agrees with what I am saying.
First and foremost, they need to listen to teachers. And I think we've come a long way in the last few years in bringing teachers into the conversation, but we're definitely not part of the decision making yet.
And one of the things that I would love for decision makers to start considering is like this one curriculum is not a fit for all. Just like, you know, one type of aspirin does not cure all the patients in an entire hospital. So what I mean by that is like our state is huge and the requirements for kids in the UP might not be the requirements for kids in Flint. So allow teachers to customize the learning according to the needs of that community. So to the legislators, I say just hands off, just let the people who trained to do this do the job.
Education commentator Matinga Ragatz. Matinga, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, Rachel Denhollander was the first survivor of former sports doctor Larry Nassar to go public. We'll talk about what she's feeling today on this day that MSU's interim president John Engler resigned.
We are 2 years into this. Larry is one of the most prolific pedophiles in recorded history, and MSU has not commissioned an independent investigation to find out what went wrong beyond any illegal conduct.
That is in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Very early in the Trump administration, top officials talked about resurrecting something that had not been done since 1950, putting a question on the census form that asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? That policy idea turned to action last March as Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross approved plans to add the question to the 2020 census over the objections of the Census Bureau. And that triggered a flurry of lawsuits. This past Tuesday, a federal judge struck down the citizenship question in one of those lawsuits. Judge Jesse Furman of the Southern District of New York blocked the Commerce Department from adding the question to the form. He says it breaks the law. With us is Barbara Anderson, a professor of sociology and population studies at the University of Michigan, and she is the former chair of the U.S. Census Scientific Advisory Committee. The first question, Barbara, is just what were the committee's duties? Particularly, what did you do?
Well, the committee's responsibility is to advise the Census Bureau on all scientific matters. Its specific mandate is to give the best advice possible to the director of the Census Bureau.
And you served on the committee either as chair or a member of the committee for how long and when did you leave?
For 7 years, and for the last 3 years of that, I was the chair, and that ended last August 15th.
What did you think when you first learned that the administration wanted that citizenship question put on the 2020 form?
Well, I thought it was a really bad idea. With everything else going on, it's clearly going to suppress response. It's going to discourage cooperation. And also, in the 2010 census, there were about 250,000 local organizations that cooperated and encouraged census participation, various kinds of local or ethnically based organizations. And this was extremely important in upping census participation. And I think that this question is almost certainly would have raised concerns from some of those organizations about whether they actually wanted to participate. And although there are very strong laws that protect individual identity on the census, this can be changed by law. The address, the identity of individual Japanese American households were used in World War II under a Special War Powers Act. And although the law now is very strong, in principle, that could be changed by Congress. And Trump recently was asking about using census data, individual census data, to provide it to law enforcement authorities. And many people in the government and in the census basically had a conniption fit over this. So it's very worrying. There also was a test of the census in Providence last May. And although the citizenship question was not on the test form, the results of focus groups and other kinds of research associated with this revealed a high degree of concern about the census, not just from non-citizens and immigrants, but also for people for whom there was any non-citizen member of the household. So it's clear that it's going to have an enormously large effect on depressing turnout. Wilbur Ross and the Justice Department claimed that the motivation for this question was to improve enforcement of the Voting Rights Act.
And I want to ask you about that because the documents and the emails uncovered during the flurry of lawsuits over this question, citizenship question, seem to show that Wilbur Ross reverse engineered this thing, that he pushed for the citizenship question first and then tried to construct reasons and a rationale for it afterward. And the judge's opinion was blistering. He wrote that Commerce Secretary Ross broke, in his words, this is in the judge's words, a veritable smorgasbord of federal rules when he ordered the question added to the census. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes. And the reasons that they gave were not true at all. And Joseph Aboud, who's a senior scientist at the Census Bureau, wrote a very extensive memo on behalf of the Census Bureau about if the concern with enforcing the Voting Rights Act were the concern, other cheaper, easier ways that this could be done that would give better results and would be quicker and easier. And as far as I know, this has been completely ignored. And I thought and thought about what is the real purpose of this question. Because if you just wanted to suppress turnout among people who mainly might be Democrats for the voters, there are cheaper and easier ways to do this.
So what are your feelings?
Well, what I finally concluded, and this is speculation, but I increasingly think I'm right, is that the actual purpose is to lay the legal groundwork to be able to change the basis of voting districts, both for state-level voting districts and also for election to the House of Representatives, from a total population basis to a voting age citizenship basis. And in 2016, there was a case in Texas against the state of Texas to challenge that they base their districts on a total population, and they thought it should have been citizens. Well, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled against the case, saying that the state of Texas had to do that. But even at the time, Justices Alito and Thomas stated that if a state wanted to allocate their districts for the state legislature on the basis of citizens or voting age citizens, that they thought this would be totally legal. And the American Community Survey, which surveys about 3 million households a year, a citizenship question is asked. But according to the legislation that authorizes the American Community Survey, American Community Survey cannot be used to allocate districts for voting.
So this is this is just the antithesis of what this data is supposed to be used
yes,
for.
Yes, so it could not use American Community Survey data to do this, although you certainly could make quite good estimates. Mm-hmm. And in 2015, Lee Labresco argued on 538 that districts based on persons eligible to vote for Congress could not be drawn because we don't have information of the kind that could be used on the citizen voting age population. So putting this on the census would give the basis for perhaps, totally legally perhaps, there certainly would be cases about it, for state legislatures, and would put in one more piece that would be necessary for something that clearly would have to be changed by law to change the basis of districts for elections to the House of Representatives.
There's lawsuits. There's certainly a strong suit, that not just this one that we were referring to with Judge Furman's opinion, but and a strong chance that the Trump administration will take this right to the U.S. Supreme Court. At the same time, we have the House of Representatives under Democratic control. What does all of that mean in your view for the fact that the clock is ticking and something has to probably be decided sooner rather than later? 2020 is close at hand and forms need to be made up.
Well, I don't know for sure what will happen. I heard an opinion or speculation a couple of days ago that the decision of the Supreme Court would probably come down before the forms had actually to be printed.
Which is when?
Well, they'd have to be start to be printed sometime in 2019. The census is started early in various remote areas. So even though the census date isn't till March or April of 2020, it starts quite a bit actually before that. But also the Census Bureau complained about this question that it hadn't been fully tested and that the testing for the American Community Survey was not adequate. Wilbur Ross argued that, yes, that is adequate. It doesn't need any more testing. In the Census Scientific Advisory Committee meeting in December that was delayed from September because of the prediction of the hurricane, which I wasn't at, but I know what happened, it was said that this spring the Census Bureau is going to do national testing of the census form with and without the citizenship question. Now, I don't know how they got approval to do this. I don't know if they're able to do that just as part of their technical mandate or whether they had to get approval from the Commerce Department. It's hard for me to imagine that the Commerce Department, if asked, would have approved that. But I think it's very good that testing is going to happen.
In the final 30 seconds we have, has the existence of this question, do you feel it's poisoned the well? Has it affected the integrity of the U.S. Census?
Well, the census itself has a lot of integrity. They're very good people.
But the way people think of it.
Yes, I think it's had, that's the right question. I think it's had a major negative effect on people's trust in the census. The census through various survey data has had an excellent reputation, which it certainly has deserved. But I think this has contaminated it to a large extent, and that I think it also is going to have an effect to increase skepticism about probably all federal data collection operations.
University of Michigan Professor Barbara Anderson, the former chair of the U.S. Census Scientific Advisory Committee, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Survivors of Larry Nassar have been calling for the resignation of interim MSU President John Engler since the earliest days of his administration. And last night, they got their wish. Engler resigned. Here now to talk about that is survivor Rachel Den Hollander. Rachel, how did you feel when you learned John Engler had resigned last night?
I am incredibly grateful that the Board of Trustees took initiative. You know, it was unfortunate that Engler was hired in the first place. It was no secret who he was and how he operated, and he was chosen by the former board for a reason. And it was their responsibility to clean up that mess, for lack of a better phrase. And I'm grateful that they did so. My hope is that this signals a change in direction and a change in tone. There is a lot of work left to be done, but my hope is that this is the beginning of change.
Well, certainly there are those on the board who are expressing that. Today, here's what we heard from Trustee Kelly Tebe.
The first thing I have to say is I'm sorry it took so long. To the survivors and your families and this community, we hear you and we're listening and we are sorry it took so long. I really hope this is the first step in a long road to really changing the culture of this institution that we all love so much. This is an important day, and I think this is a day we will all remember when the ship turned around, and we're going to right this.
Rachel, has this turned a corner for the survivor community with MSU?
No, I think it has. I think it's given us hope for the first time that we are being heard and that there are leaders on that board who understand what makes MSU, you know, a safe place for survivors. I am very grateful for the board members who took this step because it was a huge step to take. And as Trustee Tebe said, there's a lot of work left to be done, and we recognize that. But our hope has always been to move forward together with MSU and to create a better community together. And I think this can be the beginning of that, absolutely.
Special Prosecutor Bill Forsyth certainly handled the investigation under Attorney General Bill Schuette. He did not get to interview John Engler, but now we get word that new Attorney General Dana Nessel has requested an interview with Engler. What do you think about that?
I think that's an excellent first step to take. You know, he was the head of the university during the last year. We know there are at least 29 documents that Engler has withheld under attorney-client privilege. You know, and so there are a lot of questions remaining as to what really happened at MSU, as to, you know, who knew about Amanda Tomashaw's investigation, where it went up the chain of command, you know, who knew about any of the other warnings that MSU was given over a period of 20 years.
You were the very first, Rachel, to step forward and put your face and your name out there. And I found myself thinking of you immediately when I heard what John Engler said last week to the Detroit News editorial board, talking about survivors who've been in the spotlight, who are still enjoying that moment, the awards and recognition. How did that make you feel? And would you give us some idea of what it's actually been like for you in that spotlight?
Yeah, that was an incredibly discouraging thing to hear. It was not surprising because he hasn't hidden his contempt for the survivors. So I was not surprised to hear it, but it was very discouraging. Because it is again another form of victim blaming and shaming, and it communicates that he really doesn't understand why I did what I did or why any of these women have done what they've done. You know, nobody chooses to relinquish every shred of privacy and dignity to put their body on display for everybody and what's been done to it. You know, what's been done to my body is dinner table conversation for people. That's just a horrific reality that I still live with every day, and I hate it. I absolutely hate it, but it was necessary, and it was necessary because the powers that be at MSU did not listen to the first 14 warnings that they had, because USAG did not listen to the warnings that they had, because USOC did not listen to the reports they had of Larry being an abuser. Because these institutions protected a predator, there was no choice but to go completely public and to meet Larry where he was most confident in the public. And to do it without flinching. But it's not something I would wish on anybody. And the attitude that survivors do this for public recognition or for fame just completely misses what an incredibly difficult task this was, and the lifelong consequences that are going to stay with those of us who have chosen to speak publicly, because we can't ever take that back now.
John Engler declared the Nassar investigation is done and people want to get back to their work at MSU. But Diane Byram said to me the investigation is done when the attorney general says it's done. Does that answer satisfy you, Rachel?
You know, honestly, at this point, it doesn't. I'm very grateful to Trustee Byram for taking the leadership and, you know, requesting Engler's resignation. But there is a lot left to be done from an investigative standpoint. You know, MSU has not waived attorney-client privilege. It took Penn State only a mere number of days to commission an independent investigation that looked beyond whether something illegal had happened to find out the real root of the problem. And Penn State immediately waived attorney-client privilege because they wanted that badly to find out what had gone wrong. Now, we are 2 years into this. Larry is one of the most prolific pedophiles in recorded history, and MSU has not commissioned an independent investigation to find out what went wrong beyond any illegal conduct. And there's a lot that goes wrong beyond something that's technically illegal. And they have not waived attorney-client privilege, not even to cooperate with law enforcement. Those two things are very problematic. You know, the attorney general can't do the job he needs to do if he doesn't have access to the information he needs. And he and she are only able to look at, whether or not illegal conduct occurred. And there's a lot that goes on that enables an abuser that may not be illegal, but that may be unethical or negligent or simply something that needs to be done differently the next time. We need to be examining those things so that we can do everything in our power to make sure this never happens again.
What's your message to the board, to the new interim president, and to whomever becomes the new president later this year?
I think the first thing I would say is thank you. Thank you for doing the right thing today. And the next thing I would say is don't stop now. Because this isn't enough. There is so much left to be done. And I think one thing the board really needs to grasp, and I think some members do, is just the incredible power that they have. There is so much good that people who have authority can do if they use that authority to do the right thing, to pursue accountability, to pursue transparency, and to pursue caring for the people who are really under their protection, the students and the children who are going to be on that campus, and doing it with integrity. They have incredible ability to do good, and I want to see them use that.
Rachel, Dan Hollander, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's our Stateside for this Thursday. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.